And welcome, beloved listeners, to the Little Wireless program. Shortly, we're going to discuss a book I think rightly described by Robert Mann as the most radical ever to have been written by a former Australian Prime Minister. And then we're going to move on to the saga of indentured workers. When slavery was finally belatedly abolished, there was a huge shortage of labour, particularly for, the sugarcane industry, and thus began the saga of the indentured worker. About 30 years ago, Bill McMahon gave me, entrusted to my care, the manuscript of his autobiography. It was his political autobiography, and he wanted me to help work on it with him. I entrusted that precious volume to Barry Jones, who, would you believe, promptly lost it. But it was no great loss because no one wanted to publish it. It was so bloody awful. And it is, of course, the prerogative of ex-prime ministers, as soon as they leave the lodge, to protect their place in history, often by rewriting it. That was certainly the case with Hawke and Howard and Gillard, Whitlam, and Malcolm Fraser did, in fact, collaborate on a political autobiography a while ago. But then he did something quite extraordinary. He decided to write about the Australian alliance with the United States. Now, if I was an ex-prime minister, this is the book I'd write, because I wholeheartedly concur with it. And Malcolm, it's congratulations on the book. I know it's been out a while, but you've updated it recently, and it's good to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, the paperback's just come out. It's available with a postscript and update on it.
Now, let's start with Gareth Evans' sort of comment. It's a sort of a preface, and it sets it up well. There was no stronger advocate than you during the Cold War for the rewards of the Australian alliance with the US. Malcolm, why and when did you change your mind?
I had doubts about the United States and some of the things it was doing as long back as when I was Army Minister in Vietnam. But they were, if you like, minor incidents, certainly minor in the larger order of things, because then the Cold War was on. And I really believed that during the Cold War we should show, we meaning the West, should show a united front towards the Soviet Union. But once the Soviet Union disintegrated, I really hoped, I really believed we'd have the good sense to become a little more independent in our strategic policy. And, it's since then that we have become more tightly enmeshed in American affairs, in American military operations, than ever before. America has more control over Australia today than Britain ever had in the days of empire. And so I changed, I suppose, after the fall of the Soviet Empire.
When you were considering the slightly updated book, you asked yourself two questions. You ask all of us two questions. Over the last 20 to 30 years, has the United States shown the wisdom, the skill, and the diplomacy that should be the hallmark of any country with whom Australia wishes to be closely allied? And I can hear, and I'm sure you can hear, Malcolm, the entire audience to this program saying, no.
Well, they haven't. And I must say that, writers' festivals might be more inclined to agree with the book than what I say about it than the politico-military establishment led by both political parties from Canberra. But I've also spoken at some quite conservative gatherings, at groups who specialise in international affairs. Amongst the people that I have spoken to, and I've done quite a lot of it because I wanted to promote the argument, quite a lot, apart from the memoirs, which was just a book about the past. This really is a book about the future, and I wanted to promote the argument. I really believe amongst the people I've spoken to, there has been an overwhelming majority of people who believe that we are too close to the United States. at the John Batten Prize, which was the book got for the best political book for the year. I probably mischievously asked the audience at the end of the discussion, well, if you think we're too close to America, will you hold up your hand? And everyone immediately held up their hands, and I only wish somebody had had a camera there. It would have been a great photograph on the front page of a newspaper.
I must say, I've never heard anyone use the adjective mischievous for you, Malcolm, let alone you yourself. But in that context, it is apt. Now, you're right that we've come to the point where our strategic dependence on the US is a paradox. A paradox?
A paradox. Because we need the defense of America simply because we have an alliance with America. And that is likely to lead us into very considerable danger. I see we have been involved on the periphery in Ukraine, not the Ukraine, and certainly in the Middle East, much more than on the periphery to center. And in both those regions, the United States and Europe generally have made mistake after mistake, which have made the world a more dangerous and more sensitive place than it's been any time since 1946. And now the United States is paying more attention to the Western Pacific. And we're an ally. What I suppose, if any single thing caused me to write the book, it was Julia Gillard's statement about a Marine Ground Task Force being stationed at Darwin. Because I can see that being used in support of Japan and America's commitment to Japan, including the Sundaiyu Islands, is absolute. And how could we claim we're not involved if those troops take off from Australian soil? And I thought, well, you know, this is a step far too far. There ought to be a discussion about it.
Well, going back to Gareth, he says, Malcolm has made in this book a major contribution to a debate that Australia has to have, and I've been waiting for it for a very, very long time. Now, the other question you posed is this. If there is a conflict in the Pacific and the Americans become involved, do we have any option but to follow? And you assert that our constitutional independence would not protect us if America went to war in the Pacific.
It couldn't. And it couldn't for two reasons. We host that Marine Air Ground Task Force, which is very hard-hitting, has the most modern and offensive weapons attached to it. But even more important than that are the new uses to which Pine Gap is put. It used to be a very, you know, a defensive information gathering agency, enormously important and of value. But with the changed communications technology of the last 20, 25 years, it is also now heavily involved in the aiming, the targeting of a great variety of modern United States weapon systems. Everything from drones to much larger and more deadly weapons. And so that facility is enormously important to America in any war in which they're involved in the Pacific.
Now, you and I both remember a certain amount of trouble that our mutual friend Gough Whitlam got into when he dared to even think about the implications of Pine Gap.
Well, yes, he was probably right to do that, but the Cold War was still on. And I rightly or wrongly believe that the Soviet Union was a dangerous and expansionary power, and that in those circumstances we needed an alliance with a major democracy, and the only one offering, of course, was America.
Have you known, or can you identify any prime minister of the modern era who has, in fact, had the audacity, the courage to even think aloud about this issue?
Oh,
I mean, certainly John Howard didn't.
Well, people have been taught to believe that if you criticize America, you're anti-American. And, you know, debates are shut down here without argument, when the very same debate often rages quite strongly in the United States. At the moment, there's a debate in the United States from a John Mearsheimer at Chicago University, who says quite bluntly that the West is responsible for Ukraine and the mess that's there now. And he says that because the Russians believe that America and NATO broke a solemn commitment not to move NATO east, which was meant to be the quid pro quo for Gorbachev agreeing to the reunification of Germany. Now, that in itself might seem to be a reasonable deal, but to push a warlike alliance to the boundaries of Russia was really, you know, that wasn't in the spirit of the Marshall Plan at the end of the Second War. It was in the spirit of Versailles at the end of the First World War. And it was an ultimate stupidity, a major strategic mistake that was kicking the Russians when they were down, not quite out, but they're still a powerful and proud nation, and they won't forget that.
Now, okay, the Cold War is ostensibly over, although there's some sign or hint that it's rechilling. But let's go back to 9/11 and the War on Terror. Had you been in the lodge at that time, would you have done what Howard did? Would you have joined the coalition of the willing?
In 2003?
Yeah.
Never. Never. Because I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And the reason for that particular war was because highly intelligent people that very likely got double firsts at some university, like Wolfers, Munzer, Cheney, believed that if you got rid of Saddam Hussein, an American-style democracy would arise, and because of its innate goodness and power would spread throughout the Middle East. I really believe, when you read all the things about American exceptionalism and the policies of neoconservatives, that was their motivation for the war, but they would never get other countries to support that. So they developed the idea of weapons of mass destruction, which was, from the beginning, a lie.
Malcolm, how possible is it that there might be a future conflict between Japan and China wherein the US would side with Japan?
I think it is far too likely. If Prime Minister Abe wins the election that he's called, he's already torn up an important part of the Japanese constitution. He had wanted to have a referendum to alter the constitution so the Japanese military, which is more powerful than the military of any European country, with the exception of France and Britain that have nuclear weapons, but without those nuclear weapons, Japan would beat either of them. He wants Japan to be able to use its military anywhere the way other countries do. Now, he was told that he would never win a referendum on that issue. So he says, right, I will reinterpret the Constitution, and that's accepted. It's applauded by America. It's applauded by Australia. And as a consequence of that, Japan is really governed now without a constitution. Because if you can reinterpret, if a government by executive decision can reinterpret that very important part of their current constitution, they can reinterpret any part of it. And that, I think, is dangerous. But the Japanese rewrite history books. Japanese children aren't taught of Japanese atrocities through China and through Asia in the Second World War.
Yes. Well, the listeners to this program are painfully aware of some of those factors. Let me ask you this, Malcolm. What would an autonomous foreign policy look like, or what should it look like? Would it be armed neutrality? How would it operate?
No, I don't think armed neutrality. We would clearly need to spend more money on defence, but many European countries do. We're a wealthy country. If we had any sense of Australian pride, we would do so willingly. We would, as an independent country, not a surrogate of America, we would be much more effective in contributing to and participating in the diplomacy of the Western Pacific. The very real successes that have occurred in this region have largely been Asian successes. ASEAN now embraces countries that were former enemies. It's a positive, forward-looking organization, still with problems between some people within it, but they keep those problems under control. Now, this is an Asian achievement. It owes nothing to America, and nothing in latter days, certainly, to Australia. If you look at the advancement economically throughout the whole region, it owes more to China's growth than to any other single factor. When Europe has been bedeviled by recession, it's China's growth that's kept Asia moving forward. So we'd be able to participate more positively in these things if we were regarded as independent and not merely as a voice, a secondary voice of the United States.
You tell me that people put their hands up even at conservative gatherings on this notion, and as I can see a lot of hands waving at the moment. Do you have any optimism that this immense change in our gears could happen?
Oh, if you talk about the future, if you're involved in politics but are bored with the past and are fascinated by what might happen, you have to be an optimist because the alternative is just too dispiriting. So I am an optimist, yes. I'm not an optimist that the current Labor Party or the current Liberal Party would embrace, and not only the parties, but the Defence Department, the current military, although some of the past military would support what I'm saying. But the current political military class would certainly not embrace these ideas, and organisations like the Lowy Institute most certainly would not. But if there is a groundswell amongst the Australian people, if a debate starts, debates carried forward, then one day political parties or politicians may start to listen. And, you know, one of the great advantages of the current arrangements in the Senate is that neither Labor nor Liberal have control of the Senate. They have to depend on other people.
Okay. Now, you're an optimist, but of course you're no longer a member of the Liberal Party, just as I'm no longer a member of the ALP, and you haven't been for some time. What changed for you? Was it one calamitous event or a series of small incremental steps?
Some large steps, some incremental, but it would have been over the question of asylum seekers, over Tampa, over the attitude of, or the policies of Liberal governments, over playing politics with race and religion. It would have involved also, you know, attitudes that led to the participation in the Coalition of the Willing and the Second Iraq War. And the general move to the right, not only of the Liberal Party, but also of the Labor Party, which in a sense alienated me from today's political class in Canberra.
Of course, the feeling is entirely mutual. The Liberal Party does not smile upon you.
Oh, no, they do not. And I'd be rather worried today, perhaps, if they did, because I know what they believe in, and it's not what I believe in.
Yeah. Well, it's what you've come to believe in. On certain issues, you've always been rock solid. Everyone acknowledges that you were light years ahead on race, on Africa. But in many other ways, you've gone through an evolution. And this brings me to a final question, or an almost final question. You said in the first part of the ABC doco on the country, National Party, that in 75, if the positions had been reversed, Gough Whitlam would have done exactly what you did. Why do you think that?
Because he was above all a politician and knew the fundamentals of our democratic system.
I'm sorry, I'd like you to do a riff on this.
Well, ever since Charles I, if a government had, and this is an argument that I failed to get people to accept at the time, and probably failed ever since. But if you could not get your budget through the parliament, a government had two choices. You recommend somebody else form a government, or you recommend an election. Now, Gough, for the first time since Charles I, who lost his head, chose a different path, just to tough it out. And he argued that, you know, whatever the merits or demerits of the Serenists, it was not like the House of Lords. It was elected. It's part of our parliament. It has a right to be heard on these issues, as does the representatives. And that is something that he did not accept. I thought the argument was solid. And
Malcolm, the current government, of course, are having a lot of trouble getting their budget through a difficult Senate. I understand the Prime Minister is busily removing barnacles as we speak. Do you think they should be considering another election?
I suppose it depends how far they believe the budget has been defiled by a recalcitrant Senate. But a lot of the things that are opposed by the Senate, you know, when you try and fix the budget by taking it out on the poor, by taking it out on pensioners to get them to pay $7 a week when they visit a doctor, I think is a bit ridiculous. You can cut expenditure and protect the poor. The real debate on these issues just doesn't take place in Australia today. It should be on the question of increasing the GST. Quite simply, we should be asking ourselves, what level of revenue does the government need to establish the education, the universities, the scientific research, the protection for the elderly, the health system that Australia needs? And if it happens to be higher than the current level of taxation, the best way of doing it, short of stopping tax loopholes for major companies, would be to increase the GST. Margaret Thatcher increased her VAT by 7% in one go to 17%. You could use part of it to safeguard lower-income people so that they would not feel the consequence of that kind of increase.
I think you realise, dear listeners, why Malcolm wasn't invited to the G20, but why I was delighted to invite him onto our Little Wireless program. Malcolm, it's great to talk to the last lefty in the country, and congratulations yet again on the book. Malcolm's co-author with Kane Roberts of Dangerous Allies, which is published by Melbourne University Press. And thanks, Malcolm. This is LNL on RN, on air, online, on your mobile, and, of course, via podcast. The book's terrific, incidentally. Picks up where the military-industrial complex speech of Eisenhower left off. Coming up, the Odyssey of Indentured Workers. ¶¶